In the northeast corner of India, in the foothills of the Himalayas, there's Manipur, a state which has been occupied by the Indian Army for many, many years. More than 5,000 women have lost their lives or been wounded by gun violence. Writer activist Beena Lakshmi Nepram is the founder of the Manipur Women Gun Survivors Network. At a recent Women's Peace Conference in The Hague, Holland, I sat down with Beena Nepram and we talked of the women's resistance to violence in Manipur. Beena, can I start by asking you about the situation in Manipur? What's the history? Why is the conflict there?
Manipur is a 3,000-year-old Asiatic kingdom. It was the last kingdom in the Indian or Asiatic subcontinent to be annexed by the British in 1891. Our commander-in-chief was executed because of that. It was quite a brutal history. And so it became a part of British India. And when Britain left India in 1947, they said you could either be independent or join the Union of India. Our people have been an independent nation state for over 3,000 recorded years in history. We chose to be independent, but the government of India did not allow us. They imprisoned our king and made him sign a forced merger agreement on 15th of October 1949. That is how Manipur was taken over, as an act which we call unconstitutional. That is a result of the violence that is happening in our region, in this part of India, till today.
And I think it's important to say that your area of India is the northeast, and it's really quite isolated, isn't it?
Yes. Now, what has happened is, what happened to Manipur also happened to many other states like Sikkim. So now, all this area of India, called as a direction as the northeast, is actually home, was home to four beautiful kingdoms and different other, you know, indigenous communities like the Naga community, like the Kuki community, like the Khasi community, who had their own beautiful rich tradition and history. That region is now dubbed by India as northeast of India. We have a special ministry of development. So they have turned all of us, 272 beautiful indigenous ethnic groups, into a direction. Not only did they turn into direction, they imposed a martial law here in 1958 to make us, to subdue us into submission. We have got 300,000 troops operating on the ground in India's northeast region. So today I speak not just on behalf of my place in Manipur, I speak on behalf of 45 million citizens living in the northeast of India, belonging to eight beautiful states, which are struggling through to become full citizens of our country.
When we think of the independence of India in 47, we just think of the newsreels that we've seen of the British leaving, but we don't think about what they're leaving. And so you're just explaining to us these four beautiful kingdoms.
So right now, I always say the idea of India, we are still not a nation. For me, India is an idea which is still in the making. That is the reason why, even if India calls itself the world's largest democracy, as long as military boots are in our part of India, we will not accept that India is a full democracy. What kind of democracy where martial law is imposed, where anybody could be arrested, picked up, raped, killed on mere charge of suspicion, and we cannot even go to courts? What kind of democracy which violates even our own constitution? So we are still, yes, after the British left, a lot of focus was on India and Pakistan. But what happened in the eastern front of India was another mess, which is still going on, which has resulted in 50,000 killed as a result in my part of the India that the world doesn't know, because news from this part of India doesn't reach out. Even our work had to do with a lot of struggle, where we were told, don't speak about northeast of India, outside the four corners of India. You are as Indians as we are, yet we are always asked, which country are we from? The term Chinkis is given to people living in this part of India. Massive racial discrimination, profiling and abuse. Our women are taught the stereotyping of our people from this part of India is first, we are called chinkies, people who look like, they think that our allegiance is towards China or other countries than to India. Number third, they think women are morally loose, that they can do anything. So many of them are cases where we have packed dead bodies of women because they were brutally murdered in their own flats in India's capital. So we have all these challenges right now which we are struggling, but I all call it as a part of a churning process. What we are doing is to deepen democracy. In spite of the fact that we are threatened for our work, we continue in the belief that what we are doing is right. It is actually asking India to adhere to its own constitution, which says every Indian has a right to life. We don't have a right to life there. Number two is the fact that India has signed up to Universal Declaration of Human Rights, being a member of UN. So we are all asking those principles to be followed by the great nation which Mahatma Gandhi was born and killed. We are now worshipping the man who killed him, by the way. Last month, the statue of Nathuram Godse, who killed Mahatma Gandhi, has been put up in Western India. So I don't know which direction we are heading for. Prime Minister Modi and his cabinet gives a lot of sound bites saying that they want to develop the northeast region of India. Their development paradigm is to build 164 mega dams in one of the world's highest seismic zones. We are in the top 8 seismic zones of the world. We saw the earthquake in Nepal, and it's coming to our region too. The kind of development which the present government of India wants, we reject that. It's not a development which is sustainable. It's not a development which takes into confidence the people of the land there. So we are deeply concerned and we will resist.
It sounds as though you must have a lot of resources up there for India to be this interested. We all know that India's just got these new trade agreements, hasn't it? Yep. You know, the extraction industries are really welcomed.
Absolutely. We are at the threshold of history where people have to fight back. And this is not a cliche. Conflicts are always taking place in areas which are resource rich. And absolutely, you're right. Bang on. The northeast part of India is a region where India's first oil was found in Assam. It is a place where we have uranium. And the hydroelectric potential comes from there at the cost of our lives and our land and our future. We are not against development per se, but development which do not take into confidence the wishes of the people takes into, but rather makes us into stupid people, which they can just think they can buy off our leaders and sign in a fake agreement and actually rape our land, our resource. It's raping. It's not about rape, about women raping Mother Earth for your greed. And Mahatma Gandhi says it's enough for everyone's need, but for not for everyone's greed. So this is the challenge that we are facing. We are acutely aware that it is our oil, our gas beneath us, which the government of India wants. And we are not saying we will not share, but do it equitably. They are not doing it equitably.
Do you have minerals as well?
This part of India has the highest forest reserve left in the country. I don't know which names of minerals, but yes, our office have received information of different ethnic indigenous groups having submitted to us papers. One day they found some machines operating in their land. Because in that part of India, a lot of land are owned by village headmen. Okay. So what they do is they corrupt the village headmen to such an extent, and they will give the permission, okay, go and do what you want. Right now we are observing, we are documenting, and we will be raising our voices, however difficult it may be. But yes, it's not easy times for many of us, of the minority community, indigenous community, people who live in so-called fringes of Indian society, the Indian that is defined as the Indo-Gangetic belt, where it's only focused on higher caste, and India dominated by high caste people who are only in Delhi, Mumbai, Kolkata. Yes, they have the money, the resource, and they have the military. But for us, we also know that when people resist, no bullet can touch us too. They may kill some of us, which they have done. But our voices, when amplified by people like you in Canada, one day we will get to ensure that our governments do what they are mandated to, not act as spokesperson of multinational and corporations in my country.
What is daily life like for the women living under this military terror?
You have asked a very, very seminal question. Our lives start very early and end around 5 o'clock, because after 5 o'clock, it's like a military curfew. We live it each day. I never knew about nightlife till I came out of our region. We don't know what is nightlife. We cannot even dream to visit friends for dinner. It's impossible in our part of India, because it's like a military curfew there. Only military, insurgents or dogs move at night. It's a state of fear that we are subjected to. And we try to finish all our meetings before 3-4. By 4 o'clock, people start panicking to go home. The reason is it's only in the night where mostly the arrests are done, the killings are done. So people try to get home for their safety, but even we are not safe there. So we live our life in a constant state of fear. On one hand, we have the military. On the other hand, we have armed insurgent groups. And recently of late, we have got a series of bomb blasts. This year in 2015, we had over 31 bomb blasts, which has taken over a dozen lives and injured many others. And we still don't know who did it, whether it was the military or the insurgents. The thing is, if the insurgents do it, they clarify in newspapers. That means the military's hand is in it, in those bomb blasts, in our crowded marketplace. You hear about bomb blasts in Afghanistan, Pakistan, in Iraq. No one reports our bomb blasts, which has led to multiple deaths. This is the injustice we feel. We were angry before, but now we are not angry. All right, the world is too busy with their things. How can we, in our every step leads to the larger destination. So every step we take it very seriously, that wherever we go, wherever we're able to communicate, we share our story and engage to bring that change. Whether it means engaging for 10 years, we engage with the government of India. I have met the Prime Minister 4 times to remove the martial law. He doesn't listen. Even if his own committee has asked him to remove that martial law, he doesn't listen. In fact, they have imposed more act there. So now we will be taking and looking forward to looking at international processes. Because I always believe after biological parents, we have government as second set of parents. And if they don't listen, we have to go to grandparents, which is like United Nations. It may be international bodies which believe in the rule of law and basic human rights. And we believe that as long as we have one earth and one moon for all of us, injustice anywhere, as Martin Luther King said, is injustice everywhere. So we've got to connect to bring that shift. So we will not rest till that happens. I have lost my own niece in a bomb blast. My parents were nearly shot. So when you ask me how our daily life we live, knowing anything can happen anytime, we are mentally prepared. If any of our family members were prepared, we may cry, but that's the way it is. The other thing of sexual violence in conflict, very interesting thing. We have got rape happen in India every 22 minutes. India is a country not safe for women, whether it's Manipur or Delhi or other place. But in my part of India, the rapes are committed at gunpoint. Our military have committed acts of rape. They raped a woman called Thangja Manorama in July 2004. But the manner in which she was raped was what made our women in Manipur strip in front of the paramilitary. They shot her 7 times in her vagina to destroy evidence of rape. Till now, no one has been punished for that rape. In fact, so interestingly, I found some of the commanders who were operating there working in Liberia, saving Liberian women. India supplies, I think, the 4th largest peacekeeping troop in the world, the United Nations. I respect that. But before they go there, they are first operating in our region. That is why in Congo, there are many, many children born out of wedlock, which the world doesn't talk about, where Indian peacekeepers have literally raped or engaged into sexual relations with, and then just got out of it without any sort of accountability. I've informed the UN peacekeeping troops out there, they've been completely quiet about it. And recently, we submitted to the UN Secretary General's office on sexual violence in conflict. The report has come out and made public 15th April. We submitted a 30-page report. Not a single word from what we support came out. So it is not just the kind of silence, a deliberate silence on the part of my government or our community in India, but I'm also shocked at how the United Nations system work not to take our voices up. And we will be writing the Secretary General after this meeting on that.
Well, there's a problem, isn't there, with immunity for all UN personnel. It means that they can't be charged.
Oh, really?
This is the problem, yes.
What? Are you serious?
Yeah, I think that the original convention came out in 1946 at the very, very beginning of the UN, that the UN personnel, the high-up ones, the diplomats and so forth, had diplomatic immunity. But now it's been extended to the peacekeepers. So you cannot charge them legally. It is very, very shocking, but that's the situation. If it's the United Nations, they have immunity. So they're supposed to be of a certain mindset, a certain behaviour, but I mean, they're not.
As I said, that is the part of India which has South Asia's longest running conflict. It's 60 years of conflict, armed conflict there. Yet India says there's no conflict. And many of the peacekeeping troops sent outside have operated here. There are 300,000 troops there. We also have a school of counterinsurgency in our part of India.
That's where they would learn to torture.
Absolutely. And not only they train, the American forces have come and trained there, Mongolian forces have come and trained there. So many of these people have been trained there. The aim is fight a gorilla like a gorilla. That's how they're trained in these counterinsurgency operations, which are operational in our part of India. And now the Indian government says, oh, this is how we have subdued insurgency in India. So come, we will teach you how to do counterinsurgency operations. So many soldiers from the rest of the world have come to India, land of Gandhi, to learn how to kill your own people. So we have quite a lot of work to do as women peace groups and women who believe in the basic essence of peace.
Canada is the number one country in mining extraction. Do you have any Canadian companies? Do you have any multinational companies in Manipur?
I have to see whether they are Canadian companies, but I know they are British companies. That I know. For dams, a lot of Indian multinationals are there, like Vedanta Group, the Jindal Group, the Tata Group. They're all there. The World Bank has started investing there. Asian Development Bank is also. That means a lot of multi-transnational groups and companies which are there. If the World Bank is there, then I think the others will follow suit too, you know. There are those challenges that we have. We know our fight is not going to be easy, but we'll fight till the end.
How are the women in your group organized?
Initially, we started with survivors. Survivors of, it could be rape, it could be that their husbands were shot dead, their children have been picked up as child soldiers, any survivors of rape, of domestic violence. But actually, it started with survivors of gun violence. We set up this network, the Manipur Women Gun Survivors Network, in 2004 to respond to a humanitarian crisis in which a lot of women, young women in Manipur were left bereaved because young men in the age of 19 to 41 were shot dead on suspect of being insurgents. So it left behind a lot of young women with young children. When we realized no support was coming to them, we set up the Manipur Women Gun Survivors Network. Before that, I wanted to be a physicist. But the situation in Manipur make us turn into this direction because we have to respond. What we did was this. We went village to village looking for those families whose loved ones have been killed in this conflict. We started looking how they live their lives, and we realized that more than 90% come from very, very poor situations. We started responding to their basic needs. Put food on the table. Is there food on the table? Are the children going to school? Where is their livelihood coming? We were not trained in that, but just a basic sense, let's live, let them live. So we started checking out in each and every household who had suffered. And that's how we started with 120 women. And we started opening their bank accounts. We started giving them money to start with weaving. So because we realized all they require was a little capital of 2,000 Indian rupees, which must be like $15 to $20. That's all they needed to start a life in many parts of our country. And they didn't even have that. So from our fellowship money, we started giving out to those people and ensured that they are able to get the yarn, the wool, the cotton to start weaving. And they started selling. And what we do, we realize the power of women and men working together. And what we did was, over 300 villages, now we have formed 37 women groups. So we have galvanized women into groups because you see, one person cannot change everything. So we believe that we need to form groups, work in total solidarity, and then force and pound our government mechanism to get our rights. That is the way we do. So what we do is first put food on the table, and once they are at least eating properly, the children are going to school, we start giving the second stage of teaching them their rights. teaching them about the constitution, what's there, teaching them about 1325, teaching them that we have our rights, and then ensuring that they fight their cases in the legal court, however difficult it may be. We just give them the act to file a complaint, even if it's not followed up. And finally, now we are really proud to tell you that now we are ensuring that we realize if we women have to really take charge of things, we need it to get into decision-making processes. We realized the 17 peace process in my part of India, not a single woman inside it. So we are, by the end of this year, trying to get 12 women inside it, because talking is fine, but doing is something else. So we would like to join our talks with actions. And that's why we say some of our women survivors from very poor circumstances, we're preparing them to contest elections from the ground, to get into local assemblies, local bodies, and we will do it. We have no money, but we will do it. Because if money would change the world, the millionaires would have changed the world. They didn't. So it's not money. It's more synergy, solidarity, and a conviction of what's right. And we are getting there. And that's how we as a team, 20,000 of us working in 300 villages of this northeast of India. And you wouldn't believe, we had our first Women Peace Congregation on 25th of March 2015 this time. And we'll be pushing the government of India in September, International Day of Peace, to listen to our demands. Manipur has more than 104 years of women's movement. So we have very strong tradition of our grandmothers, our great-grandmothers, our mothers, having resisted violence. We have three things right now. We have the women's movement called the Mairapaibe movement, bamboo torch bearers who patrol the streets at night because that's when they arrest our men and women. Then we have a wonderful woman whom I know very closely, Irom Sharmila, who is on a 15-year-old hunger strike. And we have our generation, which are trying to get that link between what has happened on the ground to making the change on a national, international level. So three layers. So Irom Sharmila is 42-year-old young woman who started fasting on November 2000 to protest against the killing of 13 civilians in a village called Malo. They were gunned down dead. We work with a woman whose son was shot dead in that episode, a woman called Sinam Chandrajini. Her two sons and her sister were shot dead in this massacre. So Irom Sharmila started protesting against this martial law, and she is on a 15-year-old hunger strike. So the government of Manipur, what they did was they charged her on suicide, attempt to suicide, and they are feeding her through the nose. Gandhians in India have rejected her, saying this is not Gandhian. But for us, she is an icon, a woman of courage who have stood by, it's a belief. I communicate very closely with her. There are a lot of challenges to her mode of struggle, but what we realize is that she is an icon and will remain an icon for us against this martial law. We are rallying and we are with her fully in the process. We're also trying to ensure that the government of India is lifting this act so that she could make her eat. On the other hand, we have talked to her saying even Gandhiji used fast as a means to an end, not to an end to a means, because we want her healthy, we want her strong, and we want her to lead our movement. She is an icon, but icons also have to come out and do things. So we at this juncture, we are negotiating with the government to remove that act so that she could eat. We're also negotiating with her so that she could channel her iconic status and join us in the movement out there for change. Yeah.
So she's been fed intravenously for 15 years?
15 years. Fed three times a day with rice, lentils and water. I just spoke to the doctor who takes care of her just about 2 weeks back before I came here. Health-wise, she's very healthy. She does yoga every morning. She writes poetry. The place where she's detained is a hospital. So she can walk in the corridors, she can communicate, people come to visit her, things like that. But yes, it's not easy, you know, it's not easy. Last year, government of India, government of Manipur have released her, but she said she will not eat again till the act is removed. There is an impasse at the moment as we speak. Fasting, it's a weapon, but we should know how to use that weapon. You cannot just hold the weapon and keep it with you. We have to share that. Icons have to connect with the masses.
What are some of the other strategies that are used by the women?
Women in Manipur, as early as late 1970s, our mothers have built bamboo huts. If you come to Manipur today, they are there in those bamboo huts every night taking turns. And when they see an army convoy coming, they take the stone and do a clanging on the lamppost, and women gather. So that is the first historical line of movement our women in Manipur have done. We are just a tiny dot in their entire movement. Patrolling the streets of night, they've engaged with ensuring that the issue is known and engaged even the government of India on these issues. As I said, when Thangjo Manorama was raped and murdered in 2004, our women stripped. They're stripped. I don't know whether you've seen that image. They're stripped and they said, Indian army, come and rape us. Extraordinary forms of protest that women in Manipur have done. Their stories never come out. You see, that's a tragedy. Their stories of courage, of collective courage. One person cannot change this world. It's too much. Collective strength of women is what is needed to drive home the point. But their stories of collective courage never comes out. That is something which we're also looking at. Why is that so? For talking about these issues, we have been called anti-nationals in our country. One day, India will thank us for deepening democracy. We are not anti-nationals. We are people who believe in the basic essence of rights and justice, for people whose voices have never been out there. And we want right-thinking individuals, men, women of my country, India, a country which gave non-violence to the world, and to friends around the world, to please listen to what's happening and help us to get our voices out, to ensure that we're able to move our governments, whom we have created, to think right, to bring that sense of justice and peace in our hearts, in our villages, in our towns, in our localities. We are all connected in one form or the other. If today I espouse for Manipur, it's not because I'm parochial and thinking only of this. Charity begins at home, they say. If I cannot change my region, how can I claim to change the world? So we have to make our places right for our children to live a peaceful life. Thank you so much for listening, and our love and good wishes to the people of Canada too who are listening to this, that please come and visit us, you know. Change starts. Peace is not when there's a peace talk. Peace is when you taste each other's food, wear each other's clothes, visit each other's homes. It starts like that. It's when people visit each other, connect with each other, feel that love in each other. Because nation building cannot be done at gunpoint. It has to be done with a lot of love and care.
If you would like more information about Beena Lakshmi Nepran and the women that she works with, you can go to the Manipur Women Gun Survivors Network. They have a website which is very up to date. You can also go to Control Arms Foundation of India. Control Arms Foundation of India. And the last website that I'm going to give you is the Northeast India Women's Initiative for Peace, which goes by NEIWIP. Beena Nepran also has a Twitter account, which is Twitter at Beena Nepran. B-I-N-A, capital N-E-P-R-A-M. This is Rosemary Wally with Laura Yaris in Montreal.